You've landed inside Launch Street, the Business Innovation Podcast, where we interview top innovators out there shaking things up so you can innovate, differentiate, and get further faster. Since you're here, we know you're the type of person that recognizes the importance of unlocking your innovation advantage so you can compete and win. And now, your host, the person that has worked with leading companies like Disney, Procter & Gamble, Arrow Electronics, the U.S. Army Research Labs, and Red Robin on upping their innovation advantage, Tamara Gontor.
Hello, hello, innovators. Tamara here, your host extraordinaire. This podcast is brought to you by Brility Digital, business growth strategists who examine your company and its challenges in order to utilize the appropriate digital resources and tools to move your company forward. And hey, check this out. I didn't want to just bring you a sponsor. I wanted to bring you some valuable insights. So I interview the founder of Brility, Derek Kuhn, partway through the podcast. He's got some good stuff to say, so listen for that. And also, you'll see that they have a digital assessment that they are offering to our listeners free of charge. It's something that other clients pay a ton for. So whatever size of business you are, I would suggest that you click on that and check it out too. The link's in the show notes. All right. Pivot, disrupt, transform. Three words that can be kind of invigorating and kind of scary all at the same time. They take you on an emotional roller coaster. Yet, I think we all know they are essential in business today, in leadership today, in the roles that we're in. So many of the traditional ways of doing things are gone, or they're going to make you irrelevant. Both are bad. So with that in mind, I have on Marcia Dasko to talk about all of this kind of stuff about how to pivot, disrupt, and transform. She's one of the world's leading business strategists and author of the book, wait, can you guess the name? That's right, Pivot, Disrupt, Transform. So what struck me about our conversation wasn't just how to innovate, but also what to stop doing as leaders. We need to stop doing as many things as we start doing. And in some of our cases, maybe even more. All right, let's dig in.
Marcia, I'm so looking forward to this conversation. I can't wait to dig in.
Me too. We'll see how deep we can go.
As deep as we can. All right. Yeah. So speaking of going deep into the recesses of your memory, what's your first memory of being innovative?
Well, to me, innovative means something very different. And when I think back about thinking differently, the first recollection that I have is when I went to an Iowa cornfield with my grandpa and my dad. And I was about 4 years old. And my dad said to me, don't get lost, because the stalks were over 6 feet tall. And I'm a little kid going off to play. And of course, I got lost. So I started to cry. And then I was calling for my dad. And he said, where are you? And of course, I didn't, you know, I'm in a bunch of corn stalks.
Right, I'm in the corn.
Yeah, exactly. So so I stopped crying because he heard me. And then he said to me, keep crying. And I'm like, what? You know, like, your parents never say, keep crying. They always say, stop your crying.
Right.
And so I didn't know what to do. So that was, I think, probably the first time that I can remember that such a bold, different idea was put in, you know, into my head to do the opposite, to do something different. And so when I reflected back on, wow, what was that first innovation? That wasn't taking an idea to market, which is the way that I define innovation now, but it always starts with thinking.
Yeah.
Different, thinking bold, thinking something disruptive.
So thank you for clarifying that, because I wasn't sure where you were headed. I'm not going to lie. I was like, I wonder where she's going with this one. But I think your point is really well taken, which is it's about thinking differently in whatever it is you're doing, and or about your work or about the situation in front of you. And sometimes doing the opposite of what you think is the normal is actually the better thing to do. We just don't think that way. And that kind of leads me to the big question I wanted to open up with you before we get into your book, which is something that I think people talk a lot about, but they don't really have any context, real world context for why. So let's talk about it. Why is business as usual no longer good enough?
business as usual was never good enough, I think, because
I like that.
Business as usual, what's usual? Because from back in whenever business started, it's always either had to improve or most likely innovate. We had to, the innovators of the time, the business people at the time, they were always trying to improve their product, their service, their marketplace, their the growth of new markets. So there is no business as usual, but I think that the greatest thinkers are always thinking about how can we not only improve, because I see business strategies as three things: improvement and quality as a business strategy, innovation as a business strategy, and quality, you know, focused quality to serve clients is a business strategy. So those three, improvement, innovation, and quality as business strategies, are foundations, and many organizations don't have them. But if they focus on those things, they're always going to be creating new products and services and new markets. And I think that's the definition of business as usual, is always disrupting itself.
So a couple questions for you. One is, do you think, I call it the old days, but you know, business, and let's call it the 70s, 80s even, although those were transformative times and different reasons, do you think we could just do the same thing for longer? Meaning like our ability to do what's quote unquote working in the moment is shorter than it used to be. Hopefully that question even makes sense. I can see the cycles in my head. I'm not sure I'm asking the question clearly.
Yes, I think that the business cycles are getting shorter and shorter and shorter. And so that means what lasted for decades now is only lasting, if businesses are lucky, a few years. When we even think about in the dot-com era and the 1990s even, any company that put dot-com behind their name got money thrown at them by the investors in the VC world. And then, so there were like over 100, you know, pet companies, but only a few, you know, shook out. The same thing is happening now. The same thing is happening with the home delivery services. I just heard on the radio yesterday that DoorDash just surpassed Grubhub or something like that, and Uber Eats is stagnant. So, you know, those are the top three. And there are probably hundreds in the market right now, but which ones are going to shake out, only time will tell.
Well, and I think we forget, I'm just going to go back in time for a second, that there were thousands of car makers when cars came on the scene. I think that's a natural, right? It's natural. You have a lot of people come in, but then only a few shake out, and then those have to innovate because then another competitor comes in and disrupts that, kind of to your point about businesses always being disrupted.
Exactly.
Let's talk about your book, because you've got like my three favorite things are the title of your book. So I want to dig into each of them. So the book is Pivot, Disrupt, Transform: How Leaders Beat the Odds and Survive. I'd love to break down each one of those. If you could give me an example, and we'll start with Pivot.
Okay, Pivot. Pivot and Disrupt they're all interrelated. So breaking them down is more challenging than saying, okay, these three ideas are interrelated.
So maybe we start with how are they interrelated, and then we'll kind of go from there.
Okay. So pivot means having, and disrupt, as they're interrelated, means you have to challenge your current thinking, beliefs, assumptions, and quote unquote best practices that are actually mostly destructive in corporation or in organizations. And then once you challenge those current beliefs and so forth, you then have to ask different questions and come up with different ideas, and then pivot both your thinking and your new processes and systems, create new ways to do things, create a new path from the idea all the way to the value that you want to serve the customer. So it's idea to value to serving customers, current customers, and new markets.
And do you have to focus on all three to stay competitive in today's age?
Yes.
And can you give me an example of either a client of yours or a company that you think is doing this really well and why?
Some of the survivors have done it well. Some did it well for a while and then have fallen off. We'll see if they come back or not. Nokia was a good example of that. I know that, for example, one of my clients came to me with a long list of issues and problems, a very toxic work environment, a 50% turnover rate per month.
Oh, wow.
He basically just wanted to dump the problems in my lap and say, here, do something with this. But he wanted to grow the company from 30 to 35 or 40 million. And I went in, took a look at it, talked to the people, pulled together a management team who would not even talk to each other because they were so critical and blaming and finger pointing of each other. Took them off site for 2 days to help them learn a new way to think and what to think about. And when they left the meeting, these people who didn't want to look at each other, sit next to each other, or even talk to each other, through that session, at the end of it, they walked out of there with a plan and they hugged each other and said, have a safe drive home.
Oh, my goodness. So I have to ask, what do you think allowed that transformation to happen? Because that team is not alone. I hear this time and time again. And it's so hard to innovate when you don't have that trust and camaraderie.
Yes. They didn't know what else to think or do. So when there were problems, failures, issues, mistakes, they pointed at each other instead of coming together and saying, something in our system, something in our process isn't working. Let's work together to figure out what are we trying to accomplish together. So what's our compelling purpose and aim? And how are we going to do it together? By working together, we can figure this out to better serve our customer. So it's back to some fundamental questions about how are we going to make it better and improve and to innovate, how are we going to make it different so we can have the competitive edge in the marketplace. So this team then went from the 30 million where they were at in a destructive environment to 300 million of 40 million, which I told the owner, I said, okay, you want to go to 35 or 40 million. You and I know that. Let's set that number aside because I don't know where we'll go. And then we took off, and both by their learning and implementation of what I taught them, they were able to go places they had never even envisioned before.
That's amazing.
That's the definition of transformation.
Yeah, it really is, isn't it? And the fact that – and I have to ask, you had said, let's put this number aside. Is that a matter of, look, we shouldn't set false goals that we, you know, pull out of our backsides? Or is there another reason to put that number aside versus saying, now that the team's transformed, let's align them towards this goal?
The reason to set numbers aside, and I want to be clear because my clients, they're so shocked when I tell them that they should not focus on the financials and the metrics and the arbitrary numerical goals. They just freak out because that's what they spend their time doing. When they have their management team meetings, if it's 1 or 2 days a month or quarterly or whatever, that's how they spend their time. When I shift my clients from, well, maybe we'll talk about the numbers if we have time at the end of the session, then I give them about 20 or 30 minutes to talk about the bottom line. And the reason is whatever they're doing creates the bottom line. So if they want, if they're not getting the results they want and they want to change the bottom line, they have to have the conversation about what are we doing? How are we doing it? How can we improve that? How do we, the leaders, create better systems for our people to work in?
You know, I love what you're saying. I'm a big believer in rewarding behaviors, not outcomes. And you're saying it in a different way, which is, you know, focus on the behaviors, not the outcomes and the activities that you want to get there, because they're going to happen regardless. One of the parts that you focus on in your book, which I found intriguing, was what leaders should stop doing. And I always love that because sometimes I'm like, oh no, I think I'm doing that. One of them that I was intrigued to see, or a couple of them actually, one of them was like performance reviews and best practices. Why are these things actually hindering innovation?
They hinder because people get into a rut and they stop thinking and they stop challenging, doing things better and different. And so, for example, with performance appraisals, let's say a company starts, they get, you know, so many employees and they say, oh, we need HR to bring in all their practices. So performance appraisals is one of them. Incentives is might be another. SPIFs, arbitrary numerical goals. These are all destructive. And the reason they're destructive is they create internal competition. And we don't need internal competition. When you ask a company what their values are, most of them somewhere on the list have collaboration and teamwork. So what they say and what they do are opposites. They say they value collaboration and teamwork, but they create a system where they pit people against each other, for example, in a performance appraisal, and they say they judge, they criticize, they blame the people, they rank and rate the people, and then they wonder why they're demotivated.
And not working together.
Yeah, they're not working together. They're not productive. And then they wonder why the absenteeism goes up, the turnover rate goes up, because they need to get rid of performance appraisals. That doesn't mean that they get rid of some of the things that performance appraisals are trying to do, for example, develop people, coach people, things like that. But also most managers don't have a clue about how to do that. So that's a huge thing about performance appraisals. There's a fantastic book written by two of my friends called Abolishing Performance Appraisals. It came, I think, in, well, 20 years ago probably, but it's powerful.
So how about the best practices? Because that's the one where, in fact, I was just on the phone the other day where someone was saying to me, oh, we need to collect best practices across our company or that our competitors are doing, which is always my favorite. Why do those hinder innovation?
So benchmarking, best practices, when people are seeking those, they're already behind. They're out to copy.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
So they're not, they don't go through the learning process. They want to see what somebody else is doing. And the fact that somebody else is doing it, they think, number one, that it works for them, which most of the time it doesn't. And number two, they don't think through the process of what is going to be interesting, an improvement, innovative, adding value to my customers and my markets. So they don't do that.
I so appreciate what you just said. And I hadn't really thought of it that way before. So I kind of want to dig into this. You had said that if you're looking for best practices, you're already behind. Tell me more about that. Because I don't know that I ever thought of it. I always thought of it as just being efficient.
No, it's so if someone wants to go check out others' best practices and benchmark and so forth, that other company is already doing what works for them and in the moment. So by the time another company studies somebody else's best practices or benchmarks, the other company may be already advancing their question.
Right, to the next thing.
And they're moving to the next thing. And these people are still in study mode. Then a copy, then of course they have to take it back, communicate and convince their their company to do it too, and then they have to figure out the how that's going to be gone, how it's going to be done, and so they're already behind.
I thank you for that. I had never thought of it that way. So for those of us on Launch Street, just like best practices are good to see, but think about where you are and why you're doing it. The other thing you said, Marcia, that I want to ask you about is you said, you know, you don't get the learning when you just pull somebody else's best practices. Why is the learning so important?
The learning in my thinking is leadership, because the greatest leaders are people who are continually learning, open to learning, committed to learning. I don't really care how they do it. Some, you know, people figure out what works for them. I've had clients and myself, it's everything from reading books, reading articles, watching podcasts or YouTube videos, going to live sessions, going to workshops and having interactions. Different things work well for different people that you have, or sometimes it's a variety. And that's so important, because interacting, having conversations with people, asking questions over and over and over again, and even further than that, when people want to learn about their customers, many times they say, oh, we'll do a survey. We'll do a focus group. Well, that's nice, but that's going to give you like 5% of what you need.
Right.
To know. What people really need to do is go out there and have the conversations with customers when they're using the service, when they're using the product. That's when you really learn. That's when you get, that's when you can get your ideas for innovation. You see how your customers are struggling, and out of that you can think of the next generation of products and services.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. As you're talking, I was thinking about when I very first started in business, I would often use other people's best practices. Like, this worked for them in the online world, so I'll do that. This worked for them and whatever, I'll do that. And it never worked for me. Never.
Oh, wow.
And, okay. Yeah. And I think part of the reason for that is all the things you're saying, and also, you know, we have our own branding, our own filters, our own processes, our own people, right? Like our own customers. So I was trying to take what worked for somebody else and plug it into my world exactly as is, without putting it through any filters. And I think that's the other challenge that we face, is we look at these best practices and we go, well, they did it that way, that'll work for us. But we have actually, even if we're in the same industry, have a whole different set of circumstances.
Yes, and we love to go after the quick fix, the give me the recipe, the make it easy for me. And it's like, you know, great leaders don't do that. I mean, some people do that, but they may be in business, and over time, depending on service and product, they may, you know, last 10 years, they may last 30, they may last 3 months. But it's because that copying doesn't challenge them to think. And great leaders are thinkers. They have two things: that commitment to continual learning and questioning, and courage.
You know, I feel like that first one comes up so much, that regardless of age, that continual, that desire to have that kind of growth mindset is so key to success, in regardless of whatever role you're in.
Yes. I remember one time being in a taxi cab with one of my clients who was a really very, very committed student and was always wanting to learn about everything. And I felt sorry for the taxi driver. He must have gotten 20 questions. That's what the guy does all the time.
Right.
Everybody that he's in contact with, he asks everybody questions. He's curious. And great leaders are naturally curious. I guess they were 3 years old and never grew up.
I love that. I hope never to grow up then, if that's what it takes.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. I am here with Derek, who is the president of Brility. So Derek, your company Brility is amazing at helping your clients think and act differently, and leverage an experimental mindset to stand out. So how does having an experimental mindset help you do that?
Thanks, Tamara. I would say the experimental mindset is essential for long-term success and predictable success. We are all about building a system that is reliable for growth. And to do that, you have to challenge assumptions. The experimental mindset allows us to put our best foot forward, adapt and iterate, and really learn what is causal to work so that we have predictable success. We really are in a dynamic environment right now. Technology is changing, business is changing, and assumptions need to be challenged. So in order to do that, we need to craft careful experiments where we can learn, adapt, and grow.
What's the downside of not experimenting?
The assumptions. I mean, you see Blockbuster gets wiped out by Netflix. There is a graveyard of companies out there who thought they had it figured out, and they marched towards a certain doom because others were out there experimenting and figuring out what works and what doesn't and adapting to the changing marketplace. Amazon runs 10,000 concurrent experiments at once. There's a reason they dominate e-commerce. Google does the same thing. Facebook does the same thing.
Wow. So can you share with me one example of how Brility did that for one of your clients?
We have a GIS client, which is a type of software that does mapping and locations. They are a small startup, but very, very well funded. And they're going up against a massive incumbent. And they there isn't a current name or explanation for their offering. It's not commonly searched for or known. And what we had to do was run dozens of experiments to see what language at a high level resonated with their audience, which were anywhere from engineers to salespeople to VPs. And through that, we really found what surprised us most was not outcome and benefit-based promises, but actual screenshots of the technology, which seemed to immediately and intuitively have the users grasp how it was utilized. And there's a shift in the marketplace that people are sick of platitudes and promises. They want to see a little bit of how things are done. Those experiments were very revealing, and we're doubling down on them for the client now, and it's very successful.
All right, launch readers, what we need to figure out, I know I'm going to go do right now, is figure out where I'm experimenting and where I'm assuming. Derek, thank you so much for coming by.
Thank you.
I'm curious, you know, kind of the subtitle of your book is How Leaders Beat the Odds and Survive. I'm wondering, kind of in your research for the book, or as you kind of pulled it together, what examples or stories, research, did you come across of leaders beating the odds that maybe would surprise you or would surprise us?
I think that people who run organizations, they hit a fork in the road. And they either are struggling and declining and eventually fail, or they are challenging their thinking and ideas and tapping in on the resources of all of their people in their organizations and developing them, and therefore creating an environment for them to learn and work and improve and innovate together. So you've got the two forks in the road. And so we've seen since the first Fortune 500 list that came out around 1955, we've seen more than 60% of those companies disappear. Some were bought up but merged in, but many of them just failed. And when they failed fast. And others that are probably on that slippery slope right now that we see, and they're struggling. They're struggling internally. Some of them are in the Fortune, 50 companies. And maybe they have in the past have had more than 400,000 employees, but they're down 100,000 employees. And then there's, the other organizations that start up and come up so fast. And it's all due, to the thinking they have. And so like right now, we have more than 6,000 startup companies in the Silicon Valley Bay Area. And yet it's predicted that at least 90% of those will fail. Why is that? Because they don't ask the right questions. They don't put systems and processes and the work environment together so that they are working and learning together and it's attached to providing value to customers.
Do you think that, you know, 95% failure rate in general, because that's true in Silicon Valley, it's true across products, companies across the US, I don't know if it's true abroad too, but is that just a natural, like, is that the natural selection of business, or can that actually be changed if people were asking more questions?
That could easily be changed. It's part of it is one evening I went to an event where there were four panelists. There was a moderator, and the panelists answered the questions of the moderator, and I could identify based on their thinking over that 1 hour time slot that who would probably fail and who would probably survive and who would probably succeed wildly. And I looked back a year or two later and that exactly happened. Two people were talking only about, you know, their bottom lines, their exit strategies.
Oh.
You don't start a company thinking
that's funny.
You're going to get pull your money out of it with no focus at all on customers and markets and future and giving back or making a difference or contributing. And one man who is the startup CEO, his thinking was phenomenal. It was all about, you know, his customer and value and his developing his people and doing all, you know, strong foundational things to create an amazing company.
That's fascinating to me on so many levels. And part of it makes me laugh because it's so presumptuous, right? Like you haven't even built it yet. So yeah. How do you know it's – I have a colleague who – I adore him greatly, but he said, I have a company valued at $20 million, something like that. And I said, how do you know? And he said, I have the Excel spreadsheet. I've done the numbers. And I was like, that's interesting. Have you sold anything? And he said, no. And I said, well, I don't know that you really know that until you start to build some sales. And so you have something to project off of. And he's like, I've done the math. I was like, based on percentages of marketplace. I'm like, that's great. But I don't know, maybe it's just me. And maybe that's what you're saying or not. I'm always blown away. And it's the same with new ideas inside companies, not just startups, of, you know, people who think, I think valuing an idea based on a piece of paper is very presumptuous and usually inaccurate.
Yes, it's like when I'm smiling because your story reminds me of the many, many, many people with their ideas who go to the VC firms and say, oh, if we just get 1% of the market,
right?
A $1 billion company. And the VCs just laugh. They've heard this, you know, millions of times.
Yeah,
probably.
Yeah.
What they want to know is, what are you delivering to customers?
Right.
That's what they want to know. Is it different?
Yeah. I mean, I could go on about this. This is one of my many soapboxes that I have to get on. But it's just, I think we need to really move past, kind of to your point, though. I mean, you saw it on the panel, right? They were thinking way ahead when they haven't actually provided the value yet. So that's interesting because part of me wondered if it was really just natural selection at this point or if there was something, because that number has not moved in years, that 95%. That failure rate has been like that for a long time.
Yes.
Which is another reason to challenge it, right? Maybe it's time to start crying, right, to your early question.
Well, it's sometimes I teach MBA classes, and I taught one last year, and we were talking about leadership, and my class said, Marcia, why is it that we haven't heard before what you're teaching? And we're in one of our last classes of our MBA program, and no one has presented us these ideas. And I hear the same thing from my clients. The CEOs, the presidents say, Marcia, why haven't we learned this before? And I said, because most colleges and universities are not teaching it. And we need to be teaching systems thinking, statistical thinking. And I don't mean the old statistics of chi-square and t-tests, which I took, but instead we need to be teaching about how to think about theory of variation and what Dr. Walter Schuchart taught about plan, do, study, act, and how to create control charts, which are very simple. And those basic tools are needed for leaders to know how to manage and have statistical control, you know, of the organizations.
Yeah, it's really bringing it back to some true critical thinking skills
that we have
lost along the way, for sure. I want to bring it back to you for a minute. When you think about kind of your approach to things, how do you innovate?
I ask questions and I have conversations with either my clients and or some of my toughest colleagues to challenge me and challenge my thinking. And I'm continually learning, I hope. I'm an avid reader and I love to go to workshops and conferences. And when I'm also invited to be a speaker, I always interact with my audience. I don't care if it's 20 people or 200 or 2,000 people. I want interactive sessions. And that's how I keep learning. So I keep asking, you know, how are people learning? How are people thinking? Why are they doing what they're doing? How can we help them think differently? And yet it comes back to, they need a foundation. They need a theoretical, foundation, a framework in which to grow their organizations or make a difference with their organizations, add value. Some organizations don't want to necessarily grow, but they do have members or students or the military. So they have people to serve, and they need to be thinking always, you know, how can they have a value add mindset? Sometimes it's about, you know, having that competitive edge, but sometimes it's like about adding more value to the people they're serving or their members.
Yeah. And growth comes in a lot of forms. Sometimes that's revenue. Sometimes that's members. Sometimes that's value you provide, kind of to your point. It's so many different ways. In your work, what do you see as kind of the top things that stops teams or organizations from innovating?
It starts with the thinking. So if there is a lack of leadership that's not asking the right questions, then innovation doesn't flourish. It doesn't even start, because what needs to happen is the leaders have to create a system for innovation. The system for innovation is different than a system for improvement. I once went to a conference in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and it was a two-day conference about innovation. And the entire 2 days, no one talked about innovation. They didn't understand what innovation was. There was 2 days of speakers talking about improving their organizations, but not innovating. Not one speaker talked about making their organizations provide different and bold and radical, you know, services or products. So it's like, oh, wow, that was not a waste of 2 days, but
not the most productive 2 days you've ever experienced.
Yeah, you know, I expected. I really wanted to go hear more about innovative companies, innovative thinkers, innovative systems. But the language of innovation is different than the language of improvement. And the system that needs to be creative, the ability to create a system where people can take risks and experiment and try new things. I mean, I guess Apple is one of the best examples for that.
Talk to me a little bit about, because what you said is really powerful, that the language of innovation is different than the language of improvement. Give me some distinctions to separate those two for those of us on Launch Street leading teams and thinking, well, improvement can help drive innovation. So how do I think about those two things?
The language of improvement is, how do we make it better? How do we make more? How do we increase? But innovation is, how do we make something, how do we create something that's new, bold, different, never been done before, serving a new marketplace, not just improving to satisfy current customers, but doing something that has never been done before is, and creating new customers and new markets, new strategies, out of a new system. That's the difference. One is better, and one is, you know, better and more, and the other is new and different and bold.
I like that. I like that last, better and more versus new, different and bold. Before I ask the last question, where can people go to learn more, buy the book, connect with you?
So the book Pivot, Disrupt, Transform is on Amazon. It's on BN.com. It's in some Barnes & Noble bookstores. It's on various websites out there. And to connect, I'm on LinkedIn. I have my website, which is mdashgo.com, which is always a challenge because of the spelling of the last name. But it's M-D-A-S-Z as in zebra, K-O.com, mdashgo.com. And I look forward to questions and engaging with people. And I've also got a weekly column in the Silicon Valley Business Journal. It's a leadership column, a Q&A, where people can write in their questions about leadership, and I try to help answer those.
Awesome. And we'll put all those links in the show note. Last question for you is, what's the first step we should take to pivot, disrupt, transform?
Slow down, think, challenge, and whatever you're currently doing, and back up and reflect about what you want to do, why you want to do it, how you're doing it, and how you could do it differently, and then get my book to help.
I love that, though, the what you're saying about slow down and ask, because we assume our starting point is what it is, and that takes us down a path. But if we actually stopped in the beginning and said, hold on, why am I here? Is this really the problem? What am I really facing? Is that really true? It's amazing the different paths that opens up when you start to realize some of those are just things you're taking for granted. Marcia, thank you so much for joining us. This was absolutely fantastic.
Thank you very much.
And that's a wrap. I feel like Marcia gave us some great context for what pivot, disrupt, and transform even mean. And now that we know what it means, we can put it into action. I think that's the beauty of this interview, is it gave us some concrete ways of thinking and doing. So let's go do that. And hey, to get you started, go to our website and take the free innovation assessment, the IQE, to get a glimpse of your innovation superpowers. It makes all that innovating easier to do when you know your natural strengths and how you do it. All right, Tamara out.
Thanks for hanging with us on Inside Launch Street. If you know someone that is truly ready to unlock their innovation advantage, have them join you on Launch Street. Discover your innovation advantage. Build a team of high-performing innovators and ignite ideas and solutions that create massive impact. G-O-T-O, launchstreet.com. Remember, innovators, if you don't take the leap, somebody else will.